This week's show is sponsored by Audible, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
Y'all ready for this?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser and the Rude Pundit, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. Rude Pundit is back with us this week. Welcome back, sir. Hope you enjoyed your vacation.
I did. It was a blast.
Awesome. Well, folks, the Rude One and I have a lot to talk about, including the Michael Brown shooting. I didn't mean to feminize him. Sorry about that. The Michael Brown shooting, an update on the U.S. campaign against ISIS in Iraq. And then we're going to talk about teabaggers and Benghazi.
Wow, that sounds sexy.
Then we're going to have Nate Silver's analysis of what Hillary Clinton's vulnerability or lack thereof is on her left flank. And finally, we'll give an update into the race to control the Senate in the 2014 elections. If you want to write to me and give me your feedback about anything we talk about on the show, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may read your email on the air next week. Again, that's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. Need to have some more water to drink. Our top story on the Michael Brown shooting begins now. Rude One, I was on your blog today.
Shocking.
And I noticed that you had some things to say about this whole Michael Brown thing. I was wondering if you would give that intro.
Well, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, obviously, to say about it. And in the wake of the release of the police report from the Ferguson PD, that shows that Brown was probably more than likely involved in what they called a strong arm robbery at a convenience store. And the way that the media was portraying that, not just the media, but the Ferguson police were portraying it as if it was giving some reason, some excuse why he deserved to be shot. I mean, his family was even saying, you know, this is a smear campaign against him. And so he did. He went into the convenience store. He stole the Swisher sweets. When he was confronted by the guy that was running the store, Swisher sweets are,
I was just going to ask you what that was.
They're little cigars, shitty cigars, but a box of them, but apparently the box he got cost $50. I mean, I have smoked a few Swisher sweets in my time.
You have?
Of course. Who hasn't? Who hasn't smoked?
I didn't even know what they were.
Sweets and drunk, right. Had Mogan David to drink, and you know, sitting in the football stand.
So he's a shoplifter. Is what
he
you're
was.
Saying.
Well, he reached over. He grabbed. They called it a strong arm robbery because the owner of the store went to close the door and lock it to prevent Michael Brown and a friend from leaving the store, and Brown roughed him up a little. You can see it in the video and the stills. Is that he, you know, did sort of shake him up a little bit, and the guy let him go.
Okay.
Now the cop says that shot Brown said he didn't stop them, Brown and his friend, for the robbery, even though he was looking.
That came
for
out
it.
Today.
Yeah, that
right?
came out today.
He didn't even know about the robbery, as
right.
a matter of fact.
He stopped them for jaywalking. Essentially, that's what it was. They were walking down the middle of the street and he pulled up and said, get on the sidewalk. Whatever happened next, nobody knows.
Well, spectators say that he had his hands up.
Well, what the witnesses say is that he reached out to grab Brown and tried to drag him into the car, and then said, I'm going to shoot you if you don't, and then fired one shot. Brown took off, and the cop got out of the car at that point and shot him, and he fell. The witnesses say he turned around, put up his hands, but he was shot about 35 feet from the cop car.
On his way, getting away. Okay.
So that's what they, what the witnesses say, and several witnesses do. In fact, there was something today, actually really fascinating, that, you know, that that somebody was live tweeting it as it was happening outside his house, and he was saying, "Holy, you know, there's some guy just got shot dead right outside. He was running away." I mean, this is a you know, in court, this would be like almost unimpeachable. That, you know, Twitter has the timeline up of when this guy is reporting, and he even has a photo up of Michael Brown laying there in the on the sidewalk.
And so much of this about how the cops have handled this is shady.
Oh,
to use a term.
Oh, it's f***ed up. It's just it's.
I mean, the release of the video this morning,
mm-hmm,
about the robbery, which had nothing to do with the shooting. And then you had the fact that they have kept the guy's identity secret, the police officer. Why was he allowed to have his identity kept secret for an entire week? If you or I shot somebody, our name, heck, if I shot somebody, forget it. My name would be all over the place in 5 seconds. But if any normal person shot somebody, you wouldn't be titled to a week of anonymity.
Well, it's because he wasn't indicted.
Ah.
And because he wasn't indicted or charged, he wasn't charged with anything. Because he wasn't charged with anything, there was no criminal report with his name on it that would have to be released. And I don't understand, and I still don't understand, that the way that the Ferguson Police Department put it is they were only releasing this report on the robbery because of Freedom of Information Act requests from the press. They had gotten so many Freedom of Information Act requests. Oh, those annoying...
Regarding this robbery?
Just regarding any information.
Okay.
And so, including the robbery. The robbery was known about early on.
Okay, I'm going to have to say something that I'm going to have to bleep out here, because I have to call bullshit on that.
Right. You're going to bleep yourself?
I'm going to have to bleep myself on
that one. Oh, no! Are you bleeping me?
On the AM portion.
Ah, okay.
Not on blog. If you listen to Blog Talk Radio, you're going to get the full
motherfucking effect.
You're going to get the whole thing. But listen, why are they releasing the freaking robbery video? First of all, they know by this time, by today, when they released it this morning, right? The robbery video, they knew by now that the police officer involved did not know about it. So why would they think that that has anything to do with the shooting? If I light a fire today, that has nothing to do with the police officer shooting me, who has nothing to do about the fire.
There are a couple of possible things, if I can answer, you know, your claim of bullshit.
Okay.
I think that there's, if you want to give some credit to the completely awful, deranged Ferguson Police Department,
mm-hmm,
you could say that there was a Freedom of Information Act request.
Okay.
That was probably wide-ranging. And that I've actually read what they released, and their statement is, we're releasing this part of things. Probably the request was anything to do with Michael Brown. And the only part they claim that they are obligated to release is this robbery portion. They claim that because the shooting is something that is under investigation, they are not obligated to release it. So that's, of course, that's the pro-cop spin on this.
Yeah,
that this was sort of like, you f***ing want something? Here it is. We'll give you something. Look, we cooperated. Of course, the other side is it's just a f***ing cover story. It's just a cover story for whatever is going to come next. Let's make it so that Michael Brown was a badass. You get right wing bloggers out there right now, you know, saying, oh, he was flashing gang signs. You had Drudge, you know, posting a picture on the Drudge Report of him sort of doing a flipping your finger, scratching of the forehead.
Which half of the teenagers in America have done on their Facebook page.
If I counted, you know what? There was almost a picture of me flipping off America, flipping off the Statue of Liberty on the back cover of my book. But we decided to go with something slightly less.
Yeah.
Slightly less.
Good call there. All right. So, you know what? I have to say, just speaking of myself here, going away from this specific issue, I, for so long, for many, many years, tried to avoid criticizing the police department. And I won't do it wantonly, but I've come to the conclusion that this is happening way too many times. I came to that conclusion several years ago, not just for this event. And what I wonder has it always been this way and we're just finding out, or is this the last 3, 5, 7 years where it seems like these things are happening all the time? Is it new?
I think that, well, what was there? USA Today had a statistic that said that two African Americans are killed by white cops every day for the last 7 years in the United States. I believe I've got that right. And so, you know, obviously this is an ongoing thing. I mean, shit, we just celebrated the 25th anniversary of the release of Do the Right Thing, which is about the really hot summer of, I believe it was 1989 in New York City, and or 1988 actually, and it ends with the cops killing this one black character won't cooperate, even though all he's not really doing anything, he's protesting, and because he won't listen to their commands,
they kill him.
You know, it's just something that is, I mean, yes, we can say that the new militarization of the police has led to this. We can say that, you know, you give somebody enough toys and they're going to want to use those toys, and you give them the attitude that they are out there to control the streets, not out there to make the streets safe for regular citizens,
mm-hmm.
but instead they're out there to control, then you've got this attitude that you must control.
But they, you know what, I've seen a lot of talk about the militarization of the police. Police departments have had SWAT teams for years that have had M16s mm-hmm. and battering rams and riot gear and all this other stuff, but I haven't seen the type of things that we've seen this last week with them mm-hmm. really just completely... I mean, just a crowd of people that is protesting fairly nonviolently. Yeah, there were a few hooligans in the crowd, but for the most part...
We're not from Ferguson, by the way. Most of the people that were arrested for looting, in fact, I think all the people who were arrested for looting were from St. Louis.
Okay, but I mean, and there weren't that many of them.
Right.
There was no reason for the use of force that the police had against these people,
including being on the top of an armored vehicle with a sniper rifle pointed at the crowd.
Yeah, and look, there have been some very high profile situations. There was one in Los Angeles, if I'm not mistaken, 15 years ago, where a group of guys had very high powered automatic weapons, and they were totally overwhelming the police with firepower. And I think events like those are the reason why some police departments now have some of these what people are calling military style weapons and armor. It's not about having the weapons. It's using the frickin' weapons and armor the wrong way in the wrong situation.
You know. Okay, you know, you want to say New York City, maybe, mm-hmm. even though the cops in New York City are overzealous about all of that shit, as we saw in Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
But a town like Ferguson, 20,000 people, sure, it's a suburb of St. Louis, but St. Louis has, you know, has their own SWAT team and things like that. Towns like... Somebody else was quoting on Elkhart, Indiana. Elkhart, Indiana is a little hole in the middle of with an armored personnel carrier.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that was actually in the Rand Paul editorial in Time magazine where he was talking about...
Well, he's trying so hard to get progressives to vote for him. So hard. And yeah. It's not going to work.
No, no.
but go ahead.
But anyway, so you know, we're seeing this, that it's just leftover military equipment that... We got to do something with it, so let's sell it, or in some cases, give it to...
Yeah, these small towns, they don't need it. Keep it in the National Guard armory for the state, and if they need to drag it out for some sort of major disturbance locally, then the National Guard can do... Isn't that what the National Guard's supposed to do?
I guess so. I mean, you know, it's supposed to be there to quell uprisings, yeah. And this wasn't an uprising. This was a protest, you know? What happened out in Nevada... with that Looney Tunes guy wanting to let his cows...
Bundy.
Clive and Bundy. Bundys are just not... People with the last name Bundy, just got to avoid those.
Yes, especially Ted.
Yes, Ted's, Cliven's...
no longer alive.
Yes. But, you know, that was an uprising.
Yeah.
You know, that was an uprising, armed uprising. And did anybody get shot? Did they send military vehicles out? They didn't.
I sense a pattern here. Did anybody... With any of the Tea Party protests, did any police departments that you're aware of send armored personnel carriers to monitor the protest?
No. Are you kidding? They really lost their fucking minds.
I'm sensing a pattern here that left-wing protests and just general civil disobedience that is not right-wing seems to get this full response, and right-wing protests...
I mean, but, you know, and 9/11 and the Patriot Act become an excuse for this.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, fuck the Republicans that are now saying, you know, oh, maybe we've gone too far with this. You know, did Claire McCaskill, who's now, you know, really out front on the militarization of the police and saying it's time for us to pull back on that. Did she vote for the Patriot Act? I bet she did. Since the Patriot Act generally passes unanimously when it's up for renewal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, any of them that voted for the Patriot Act, you know, just have to shut the fuck up about this. It's your fault. And so we have this overzealous response to anything post 9/11. This is one of those other reasons we lost after 9/11, that America lost. Because, you know, Ferguson looked like Gaza for a little while. And, you know, no, there weren't missiles being launched there. But anytime you have that kind of response, and with tear gas being fired, you know, tear gas being fired into people's homes, it's insane. And so, you know, if we're gonna have this as our country now, then again, as I say, with every kind of excess that comes up, let's have this debate. Let's say, are we gonna do, is this what we want? Is this our America?
That's a good point. All right. We'll be right back. We're going to talk about the update on the U.S. campaign against ISIS, but I hope the police department over in Ferguson start doing the right thing, and I hope this guy is held to account. We'll be right back. We don't get fooled again. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible. Listeners of Making Sense with Steve Laser can get a free audiobook and 30-day trial membership if they sign up at www.audibletrial.com/lasersense. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. For instance, Inferno, the latest novel by Dan Brown, is available, as is The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith. Sign up now at www.audibletrial.com/lasersense. Zero Zulix uploaded. Welcome back. Well, folks, this next segment is about, as I said, an update on how the U.S. campaign against ISIS is going, but I also want to talk about why we're here. So, Rude One, if it's okay with you, I'm going to play a little snippet from an interview that Dick Cheney had back in 1994, talking about why we didn't go to Baghdad in the first Gulf War.
I love a blast from the past.
All right, here we go.
Do you think that the U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad?
No.
Why not?
Because if we'd gone to Baghdad, we would have been all alone. There wouldn't have been anybody else with us. It would have been a U.S. occupation of Iraq. None of the Arab forces that were willing to fight with us in Kuwait were willing to invade Iraq. Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? That's a very volatile part of the world, and if you take down the central government in Iraq, you can easily end up seeing pieces of Iraq fly off. Part of it the Syrians would like to have to the west. Part of eastern Iraq the Iranians would like to claim, fought over for 8 years. In the north, you've got the Kurds, and if the Kurds spin loose and join with the Kurds in Turkey, then you threaten the territorial integrity of Turkey. It's a quagmire if you go that far and try to take over Iraq. The other thing was casualties. Everyone was impressed with the fact that we were able to do our job with as few casualties as we had. But for the 146 Americans killed in action and for their families, it wasn't a cheap war. And the question for the president in terms of whether or not we went on to Baghdad and took additional casualties in an effort to get Saddam Hussein was how many additional dead Americans is Saddam worth? And our judgment was not very many, and I think we got it right.
You know, I was on active duty during the first Gulf War. I was in the Air Force. I was assigned to Cheyenne Mountain Air Force Base, which most non-military folks know as NORAD. It's actually not an active base anymore. They call it a warm base. It's ready to go in case we ever have a big enough threat to where we need a nuclear bunker like that again. If you actually go onto the Wikipedia site for Cheyenne Mountain Nuclear Bunker, there is a reference to me in the Wikipedia page, because I actually did, at one point, a three-dimensional drawing of the interior with AutoCAD when I was on active duty. But anyway, the reason why I bring that up is at the end of the first Gulf War, when the president announced that we weren't going to Baghdad, I remember being in the dining hall at Cheyenne Mountain Air Force Base. I remember exactly where I was. And I remember we were all watching the screen. This was our commander-in-chief, obviously, speaking about a military operation. Kind of important if you're in the military. Mm-hmm. And we were watching it, and I remember we were all really confused. You know, I think we all had the assumption that we would go to Baghdad, that we would depose Saddam Hussein. And then the president explained it to us, and I was a young kid, and so I just accepted his explanation. And then, you know, as you heard, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, various other members of that administration, Colin Powell was a four-star general at that point, wasn't really technically a member of the administration, but they all gave this sort of explanation that if we had done that, who knows what would have come after, would have been this quagmire. Dick Cheney actually used the word quagmire. And you know what? He was right. He was exactly right. And here we are. And yet we still have Republicans. Some of them are coming around, but we still have Republicans saying that it is Barack Obama's fault that we are where we are with ISIS. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, I think that Dick Cheney soundbite should be sort of our American eulogy at this point. You know, when we're finally, you know, at the end of the zombie wars, when the cities are burning, and yet Dick Cheney is still alive.
He's never going to die.
Because of his mechanical heart, which, you know, it doesn't beat.
He's going to outlive our great-grandchildren.
His heart doesn't beat. It just whirs. So you hear Dick Cheney coming close to you. You hear... That's creepy as right there. Ugh. But, you know, I want that to be, you know, I want that to be on loudspeakers to say why we got to where we are, why the zombie apocalypse happened.
And that, well, I'm going to have to bleep myself out again. Is out there criticizing Barack Obama, saying that this is his fault.
Oh, what he said was, I mean, he just climbed out of whatever pit of that they keep him in so that he could go on some AM news thing, and he just opened his, you know, horrible maw. You know, usually worms and maggots come spilling out. But and he said they about the Obama administration, they can't blame George Bush anymore. And it's like, no, yeah, we can. You know, and the idea that, you know, that I know that this is based in the, you know, like what Hillary Clinton was criticizing Obama on for not arming the moderates in Syria, and therefore ISIS, which has part of where it comes from is Syria, that it was able to get more militarized.
Yeah, and I disagree with her on that. By the way, I'm a Hillary Clinton fan, and we can talk about that later. But I disagree with her.
So there. I'll save you know that for the next segment or a later segment. But you know, it's mind-boggling to me that anything. I mean, I don't give a what happens in Iraq. I don't care if some old guy, you know, trips over a rock and hits his head and dies, and that's George Bush's fault.
I agree.
If some little kid, you know, is walking along and can't buy a ball because the stores are closed, that's George Bush's fault.
You know what's sad, though? It's not just George W. Bush's fault. It's our fault. It's America's fault. And that sucks.
Well, you know, I'm going to take a pass. I'm one of those people that's going to say, you know, I was one of those people that was isolated for opposing the war.
I was, too. Yeah. I was marching the whole thing. Yeah. I warned that this is exactly what would happen. But you know what? As an American, unfortunately, I mean, we can say that it's not our fault because we protested against it. We were against
it. But it is us.
But yeah, we own it still. Right. We still freaking...
No, we re-elected him. We re-elected the people that brought us into it because, you know... Because, I don't know, because John Kerry, you know, didn't get enough shrapnel in his ass when he was, you know, on the
Swift boat.
The whole
Swift boat thing. Oh, man.
Yeah. But
that just infuriates you.
Yeah. So this whole issue with ISIS, you know, if we're gonna start, you know, blaming people, let's go back to, they're actually a branch off of the Mujahideen, who we armed back in the days of Carter and then Reagan.
Yeah.
You know, yes, there's a lot of people who are responsible. Actually, Obama is the one who's, you know, he's got the job, you know. Unfortunately, the presidency of Barack Obama has just been to be the janitor.
Yeah. And I was thinking about that today. You know what? He has not had his own presidency.
No.
His entire presidency has been cleaning up the garbage left over by George W. Bush. He deserves another 8 years after this. Of course, he can't have it constitutionally, but he deserves. He has not had his own frickin' presidency.
No.
What a pain to have to clean this crap up. Yeah. I would hate being him.
Right. I mean, that's it. That's what he was left with. And then the people that set the friggin' fire, you know, the arsonists, are telling the firefighter that we don't like the way you're fighting the fire. That in fact, we want to go back to what we did to the arson days. It's like you know, we have a Republican Party that just wants to watch burn, you know, and
figure out ways to blame it on the Democrats,
right? And warm their hands on it. Yeah. And so the same thing with ISIS, you know, this group, this is the monster that we created, and you know, I think Saddam Hussein is just laughing his ass off in hell. And, you know, in between, you know, barbed demons sodomizing him.
Oh,
I might have to bleep that whole line. But
I think barbed I can keep in there. Anyway, but you know what? I do want to move on just a little bit from blaming Bush and Cheney, who deserve it, to talking about what we do now and how things are going now. And part of that story and discussion has to do with what we do with our own party and our progressive wing and how we talk about things like this. Because in the forums that I'm participating in, there is this wing of the progressives in our party. And I consider myself a progressive. I call myself a pragmatic progressive because I think I have all the views of a progressive, but I also, I feel like I take into account what's really happening and sometimes what's happening on the ground doesn't allow you to fully implement what your beliefs are. And this is one of those situations. There were a lot of progressives saying that we would be just as bad as George W. Bush if we helped with ISIS, if we bombed them, or if we, you know. I get really upset when I see those kinds of things, because it's just not the same thing to make up weapons of mass destruction and save 40,000 people from a semi-genocide. How do you feel about that?
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, it's one of those things that progressives always need to wrestle with, is like, you know, I want... Obviously, you know, there's that humanitarian urge, you know. I want to go in and I want to murder the shit out of them.
And ISIS.
Yeah, ISIS. Yeah. And, you know, but I felt that way, you know, back in when the Taliban was taking over Afghanistan in the 1990s. I felt that way when the Hutu were wiping out the Tutsi in Rwanda. I felt that way when the Bosnian Serbs were slaughtering Muslims. You know, you can have that, or you can say it's okay for us to use force to stop genocide. The thing is, and the gut-wrenching goddamn thing about it is what Bush did to us and made us as progressives, and frankly in some ways as a nation, doubt that and say that any time we intervene now is going to be another debacle. And
or I've heard a lot from progressives, or it's because of corporate interests, or it's to war profiteer, or all those other things. And you know what? Every situation is not the same.
Right. Right.
You know? And we're not regime changing. We're not changing a government.
No.
We're not going to hold territory. And you know, it came out today, President Obama was talking about that, getting back to what the current situation is. we're actually, we sent 130 people to observe what was going on.
Which actually scares me, because that's starting to sound like Nicaragua, El Salvador.
Vietnam, kind of, you know. Everything, yeah, you know, slippery slope and whatever. But we're pulling them out.
Yeah.
That was announced today. We're pulling those folks out. The purpose was literally to assess what was happening in the mountains. It's one thing, I guess, to have reports. It's another, you know, we dropped some special forces in there who talked to the people, made sure that everybody who wanted to get out had gotten out. So over the 40,000 or however many they were, I think there's 4,500 left. And the story is that most of those are herders who have flocks on that mountain all the time, and they want to stay.
And let's be clear about what conditions these people were in. It's about 115, 120 degrees right now in that area.
I like it hot, but not that hot.
Yeah. And so, you know, when they fled to the mountains there, we're talking about being in a fairly barren area in extreme temperatures and just sort of, you know, there to bake and die.
Yeah. And more to the point of what we were doing, the president said that U.S. forces delivered more than 114,000 meals and 35,000 gallons of water. So once again, this is not a war of aggression. You know, this is not a war of conquest. This is not what Russia did in Crimea. This is not what Bush did in 2003. This is not what Iraq did to Kuwait, any of those things. So I think, you know, there's a lot of criticism to go around here, certainly for the Bush administration. But also, I think those of us on the progressive side need to really make sure that we're not lumping things together that are just not the same.
Right. Although I will say, probably maybe a little more than you, I understand that feeling, because every time that we're on the verge of acting, and I felt this way about Syria, I felt this way.
I was totally against Syria.
I felt this way about Libya.
Yeah.
I felt this way, and every time it's I get that gut churning feeling of, Jesus Christ, is this what we're doing again? And I know it's not the same, but. You know, I think it's good to have a healthy mistrust, but I also think that we have now been made so skeptical that in the long run it's going to harm us and obviously I think it hinders Obama's foreign policy, that hesitancy. But in some ways it's necessary and in some ways it's good, but it's always going to be there.
Here are some of the things, though, that I always try to keep in mind, and I tried to tell this to certain people. One of them is, look at what the international community is doing and saying. Is there a sizable objection to what we're doing? In Iraq in 2003.
Right.
You know, especially from some of our traditional allies like Germany, France.
Yeah.
If those people are saying, we don't like what you're doing, then we should probably take another look.
We should ban their fries. That's what we should do.
Freedom fries.
Banned it.
Oh, man.
Ban the pommes frites.
But anyway, I like the way President Obama has handled this. I think he's going about this the right way. And it still sucks.
And, you know, ISIS, frankly, is a hell of a lot scarier than Al-Qaeda right now. And you know, I want to make sure... Again, it's good to have healthy doubt, but I want to make sure that everything we're getting is not not just propaganda, you know? That is ISIS really a genuine threat to the United States, you know? Is it? Because I don't think so. I think you know, you've got a fairly well-armed, well-financed group. And once again, they're getting funding from the Saudis, they're getting funding from the Qataris. You know, they're getting funding from a lot of the usual.
Well, when you say
suspects,
the Qataris and Saudis, I mean some elements within
Not the governments.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like, when do we go after that money? I don't know. Do we freeze Saudi money that might be going to terrorist organizations?
You ask a very good question, and I want to give my opinion on this. Are they a threat to the United States? I think any group that says they want to take over multiple countries is somebody who's a potential threat. And if it's a group that has the kind of views and has done the kind of things that ISIS has done, let's say for a moment that we let them take over Iraq and Syria, which is their stated goal. They're not hiding that.
Right.
Let's say they take over those two. Is there anyone who believes that they would stop there?
No. That's why, you know, I can't honestly say with any kind of, you know, I'm a bleeding heart liberal. I am as pacifist as they come. But as a friend of mine once told me, there's a difference between being a pacifist and being a passivist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't just let happen. And, you know, this is one of those times. I mean, there's, yes, John McCain and Lindsey Graham are doing their usual bat dance of doom.
Yeah.
And yes, there's a lot of people on the left that are genuinely suspicious, as I sometimes am. But there's still something about this that on a gut level, you just say, these are terrible people. And the shit that they're doing and the things that they have already done, you know, at some point, nobody's going to negotiate with them. They're not going to want just a little piece of Iraq. They're not going to want to, you know, they want it all, and they want to turn it into, you know, a radical Muslim country. And frankly, this is what we should have done with the Taliban way back when.
I agree.
And
I was calling for that before 9/11.
You know, before 9/11, I remember.
Based on what they were doing to the women.
I was part of a group that was protesting, you know, saying the government needs to do something about the Taliban because of the treatment of women.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, instead they were visiting George Bush in Texas and trying to make deals with them. So I gotta say, there's that. I think all of us have that little bit of bloodlust in it. And this time I'm gonna say, you know, just, you know what, go Zero Dark 30 on them.
You know, we're way over time, but one of the things that always occurs to me with these types of situations is, I want a world without war. Period.
Everybody does,
well, right?
Except the
people I don't that think are ISIS does,
and the people that are making a ton of money on war.
But it always, you know, there was an episode of Star Trek, and it's always dangerous to use things like but they went back in time, right? And boy, this is starting sillier the moment. But
no, I'm gonna geek out on me. Go for it.
But the episode was based on something that was true, and there were anti-war activists before World War II.
Yeah,
that were saying, "Let's disarm. Mm-hmm. Let's not get involved in anything that was going." And that obviously was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for those of us on the progressive left, understanding when is the right time to push for things like nuclear disarmament, mm-hmm. regular disarmament, you know, bringing troops home and all those sorts of things is really important to understand it. Look what happened to Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they signed this agreement in the 1990s,
yep.
giving up somewhere in the neighborhood of, what, 1,500, 3,000 nuclear weapons?
All of the ones that they had,
but yeah. I think it was around that many. If you're a Ukrainian, do you think that was the right decision?
Yeah, I know. You thought there was going to be sanity in the world.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, you had the signatures of Russia, the United States, yeah. the United Kingdom. You thought, okay, we're going to be okay.
Yeah.
I actually think that nuclear non-proliferation right now, the world may not be ready for that. And that's really sad.
That's sad and scary because isn't it recently, I forget who was it that said it. Was it Colin Powell or somebody who said there's absolutely no use for nuclear weapons?
And you know what? You know what's sad? I disagree with him. Am I more right-wing than Colin Powell on this issue?
Probably, yeah.
But the use that Colin...
Lied to the UN, have you?
No.
Okay.
But the use, unfortunately, that nuclear weapons have is a deterrent.
Yeah.
You know, not just a deterrent to have nuclear weapons used against you, but a deterrent to have anything done against you. Does anybody think that Putin invades Crimea if Ukraine has 1,500 or 3,000 nuclear weapons?
No, of course not. I mean, you know, that's the case some on the left make for saying, why shouldn't Iran have nuclear weapons? Why shouldn't, you know, Israel has nuclear weapons. They do. They really do. And I know we're not supposed to talk about it, but they totally
have
nuclear
weapons. They have around 150 or so, I think.
But, you know, why are they not allowed to have it? You know, Pakistan has it.
Well, the Baltics.
Yeah.
We're telling them not to.
Yeah. Well, you know, but Japan. You're right. But you're right. If Milosevic had nukes, I think he would have nuked parts of Bosnia.
Yeah.
Wow, this is getting as grim as can be.
It is. We better end the session. This segment, I should say. Next
I love session. It's like a therapy session. Because this really gets back to your Air Force days, doesn't it?
Because you're good enough. You're strong enough.
You protected nukes. This is what this is about.
No, I didn't protect nukes. But we tried to detect if somebody was launching them.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Little different.
So you were ready to facilitate our launching of nukes should we need to.
No. All NORAD would do is report. That's right. It. And then we're out of it. Okay. That's what NORAD does.
You track Santa Claus.
We really better end this segment now. All right, next segment. Do teabaggers realize the Benghazi scandal is over? We'll be right back.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, Badler.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. Welcome back. Folks, a lot of things have happened in the last few weeks regarding Benghazi. We caught one of the masterminds who said that in fact, the anti-Muslim video was one of the reasons that they attacked the embassy. So the Obama administration did nothing wrong when they said that that was one of the possibilities. And then in the last few days, the GOP-led Intelligence Committee, House Intelligence Committee, exonerated the Obama administration of any wrongdoing in the Benghazi attacks. Matter of fact, Representative Mike Thompson, the second highest ranking Democrat on the committee, announced some of the results. One of them was the intelligence agencies were warned about increased threat environment, but did not have specific tactical warning of an attack before it happened. Also, a mixed group of individuals, including those associated with Al-Qaeda and Gaddafi loyalists and other Libyan militias, participated in the attack. There was no stand-down order given to American personnel attempting to offer assistance that evening, no illegal activity or illegal arms transfers by any U.S. personnel in Benghazi, and no American was left behind. And finally, the administration's process for developing talking points was flawed, but the talking points reflected the conflicting intelligence assessments in the days immediately following the crisis. So my question, Rudy, is... with the fact that just about every possible angle of attack that the conservative right and the Tea Party and all of those folks have used against the administration on Benghazi, now that those have all been debunked by no less than a Republican House Intelligence Committee and one of the ringleaders of the attack, at what point are teabaggers and other folks going to realize that the jig is up, that the scandal is over?
Well, I think they're. I would not be surprised. Are they gonna? Are they gonna primary? Have a primary opponent to some of the GOP members of this, of the select committee?
I think it's almost too late at this point.
Yeah, probably. But it's. I mean, I think this is another one of those signs of the death throes of the Tea Party. I mean, so far, the primaries in the election cycle this year have shown that, but they won't let it go because this is one of their reasons for existing. Now they might be able to move on to if they can discover some kind of scandal with Syria and ISIS, which who knows that you know what are they going to impeach on next? But yeah, this is they need this. They need to know because. This gets to Hillary.
Yes, that's why this is really important.
That's why they have to cling to this. This is why there have to be more investigations, even though this investigation said, yeah, everything that the administration said they were doing is exactly what they were doing.
Well, let me tell you one of the big differences between Democrats and Republicans and progressives and their counterpart on the far right, the teabaggers. If this was progressives that were trying to push something that turned out to be not true, which, quite frankly, we never do. But if this were progressives trying to push something that wasn't true, we would pretty much be pulling down all references to it on our websites and everything like that. You would not see it anymore at this point because we don't like to look stupid.
We would say, well, we were wrong. Next.
But, and this is something that everybody at home can do.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And I'll let you go. I'm sorry, right after this. If you go to Twitter and you do a search on hashtag Benghazi, you will still see, yeah, please do, you will still see tens of thousands of right-wingers who have no idea that their pet project, their pet issue, their pet complaint is completely gone. As a matter of fact, if you do that thing, you'll also see all kinds of funny profiles pop up with the hashtag Molin Lobby and all the other fun things that conservatives like to say and prop themselves up with. Molin Lobby is one of my favorites, by the way, Rudy. While you're pulling that up, I'm just going to say, Molin Lobby, if you're not familiar with that, it's a, I guess, what was it, Greek phrase? It means come and take it. So it's what King Leonidas said to, who was it, the Persians that were invading in Thermopylae, and he basically, you know, they said, you know, you have to surrender your weapons, and he said, Molin Lobby, come and get them. It was brave because there was 300 of them standing up to an entire army. Well, conservatives have adopted that phrase regarding guns. So they're trying to say that they're as brave as 300 people standing up to an army by sort of suggesting to folks who want gun control that Molin Lobby.
Nice. Well, apparently, what's really going on right now is Hillary Clinton is scared of the House's special select committee that the GOP has going, led by Trey Gowdy.
That's the committee that was recently set up in the last couple of weeks.
Right.
After seven other Republican committees had already investigated, including the House Intelligence Committee that we were talking about, whose report we were just
talking
about.
That's right. So according to the Political Insider, and I got this from the Twitter, Hillary Clinton is absolutely frightened that Gowdy is going to get to the truth that nobody else has gotten to.
Yes, because it doesn't exist.
Right, right.
Yeah, I'm sure Hillary is quaking in her boots.
That's right. So what do we have here? We have, here's a tweet from the GOP. Is this the official GOP?
Is it at GOP?
It's at GOP?
Yeah, that's theirs.
That's theirs.
I send many taunts in that direction. That's how I know.
It says, retweet and sign if you want Hillary to come clean about Benghazi.
So their own committee. Their own House Intelligence Committee, the folks who have access to all of the information, they have clearance, has exonerated the administration, but the at GOP Twitter, the actual official Twitter of the Republican Party, is still sending out that misinformation. I mean, what do we do with these people?
At GOP.gov, there's a whole section on why we are still doing this, why we are having this select committee to do this. It's, I mean, they can't let it go because of 2016. If Hillary were to say, I'm not running, Benghazi would be gone. We wouldn't talk about Benghazi at all anymore. This is only now about damaging the Hillary brand.
Actually, I'm going to slightly disagree with you there.
Disagree with me vehemently. Disagree with me violently.
And I'll tell you why, because I think that's one of the things, one of several things, all, by the way, lies and incorrect, but one of several things that they intend to try to impeach the president on post-election 2014. They're waiting till the end of the, they're waiting till the election's over, because the election in 1998 was hurt by the impeachment of President Clinton. Right. Republicans lost seats on account of that. So they've learned that lesson at least.
Yes.
So they're going to wait till after, and they're going to impeach him. Obviously, they know they can't remove him. They don't have 67 votes in the Senate, but they want to hurt him again to hurt whoever would try to succeed him by impeaching him.
If they were to impeach Obama, I honestly think that I think there would be riots. I think there ought to be riots if they try to impeach Obama.
Well, there should have been riots.
There should have been riots over Clinton.
Over Clinton.
Right, but at least Clinton, you could at least fall back on, you know, he shouldn't have gotten a blowjob in the Oval Office. You know, God, he shouldn't have done that. But, you know, even that was, it was ludicrous.
A consensual blowjob.
A consensual blowjob, yes.
Is national and international crisis worthy.
Right. Well, no, he lied under oath. And if we let him lie under oath, then we undermine the Constitution. So, you know, again, at the very least, you could say with Clinton, sure, he did lie under oath. He lied under oath during an investigation that went off in a direction that had nothing to do with the investigation that it was what it was supposed to be investigating.
Yeah, which is, there's actually a legal term for that called a perjury trap.
Oh.
Which is not something that you're supposed to allow to be able to go after somebody for.
Right.
But anyway,
right.
Go ahead.
Anyway, so if they, but now with Obama, when you've got time and again committees and investigations showing absolutely no wrongdoing.
Yeah.
And you are impeaching him just because you don't like that black guy in the office. And that's the way, and that it'll be so easy to spin it that way when it is the all white Republicans doing it, that, you know, it is, to steal a phrase from that bastard Clarence Thomas, a high-tech lynching.
I knew you were going there. I knew it. All right. And it would be. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time, so I want to move on to Hillary, and if we can squeeze it in there, Battle for the Senate. Nate Silver came out with a very interesting article yesterday about Hillary Clinton, saying that he does not think that she has a problem on her left. Now, I am seeing, once again, on some of the websites that I participate in, have a lot of progressives on them, and some of them are saying that they would like somebody to primary her on the left. The two names that I keep seeing are, of course, Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, both of whom I love, one of whom isn't a Democrat, right now at least,
right.
And the other one has said that she's not running only about 50,000 times.
Right, and has said absolutely positive. at this point, she's essentially, if she ran, she'd essentially be giving Hillary a ton of commercials to run against her.
Yeah, actually, and I'm in ready for Hillary. I'm a huge Hillary supporter. I would actually not mind Bernie Sanders entering the race as a Democrat. Just to get some issues discussed. And believe it or not, you know, my friends on these forums think that he would cause Hillary to move to the left. Actually, I think the opposite would happen. You know, it's not a bad thing, but I think she would become more moderate because that's the space that would be left open to her.
He would actually end up giving her cover for shifting
exactly
rightward, more rightward, because I think she's kind of a...
She would seem the sane one, if I can say that. I'm not trying to say that Bernie and progressives mm-hmm. are insane, but she would seem like be able to use that to say that she's the sane one. And when it came to fighting with the eventual Republican nominee who would try to paint her as liberal, she could very simply say, no, look, this is what Bernie Sanders said on this issue.
Right.
This is where I am. You can see I'm not a flaming progressive liberal, whatever it
is. Right.
So I think that's what would happen. But I think it would still be worthwhile to have that debate and to have progressive issues discussed, because I agree with my fellow progressives when they say when people learn what progressive positions are all about and how they would work, mm-hmm. people tend to like them. So
right.
I think from that standpoint, it would be a great thing to have Bernie enter the race.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, again, people on the left are going to vote for her. There is not going to be anybody that is. I mean, Chris Christie wouldn't be strong enough. Jeb Bush would just make everybody roll their eyes. I love the idea of a Mitt Romney reascension. I mean, it's almost that's hilarious. But she's not somebody that I supported the first time around.
Same here.
Yeah. I mean, at first I supported John Edwards and, you know, look where that got me.
I was there. I was an Edwards supporter too.
Yep. And then shifted to Obama because I liked the movement, not necessarily him. I always knew he was moderate left. He wasn't a raging liberal.
Mm-hmm.
So what it comes down to for me with Clinton as a progressive who has his doubts about Clinton is what it always does. I can go back to her husband, and in 1996 when he was running against Dole, I went into the voting booth and I sat there for a while staring at it, thinking not about voting for Dole, not at all about voting for Dole. Not about voting for what's his name, crazy ears guy, who was also running.
Perot?
Ross Perot was in again.
Oh, that's right. He was in in 96. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And
I blotted that from my mind.
And it was Supreme Court picks was why I eventually said, all right, I can vote for Clinton. Because by that point, you know, Bill Clinton had shown that he was not a crazy liberal. He was somebody who was willing to go right, to just have a legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are things he did that are still, you know, problematic.
Yeah, but, you know, I think... when I think about Bill Clinton, some of the things that he did that are now things that folks on the left complain about, I don't think we understood that at the time. Like I supported NAFTA. I didn't realize how bad it was going to be. I bought what people were saying about it, and now I regret that position.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm not. I'm really
welfare
wary
reform?
Of free trade.
Where were you on welfare reform?
I was worried about it,
mm-hmm.
but I supported him.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Don't ask, don't tell. Don't ask, don't tell.
Sorry.
I'm trying to remember exactly. I know how I feel about it. I'm trying to put it in words at the time. You know, it's always hard to put you back at the moment in the time.
I remember being so viciously disappointed in Clinton. That if Clinton had come in first day, said, I'm commander in chief, the policy is over. Okay? If we want to fight on this, let's fight on it. But it was the beginning of his presidency, he would have had plenty of time to recover if any damage that would have happened. You know, you get that first little period. They didn't give it to Obama, though. And then what Clinton ended up doing, you know, because Sam Nunn, a Democrat, lost his friggin' mind over it. Same thing Obama faced. You know, Obama came in to try to do things, and what's his name? He retired. Max Baucus.
Mm-hmm.
Just f***ed everything up for the beginning of the Obama administration.
Yeah.
So it's always some Democrat that comes in and screws over a Democrat.
You know, while you were saying that, I remembered exactly where I was on this issue. And the thing is that I had just come out of the military at that point. And when Clinton announced that he wanted to fully integrate the LGBT community, well, gays and lesbians at least, into the...
Yeah, we didn't recognize
trans,
and B was just an exotic thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was so cool to be bisexual at that time period.
I remember thinking, wow, the military that I just left... did not seem ready for that at all.
Yeah.
And so I supported the idea completely. I wanted, you know, I always wanted the military to be fully integrated, but I really was concerned about it. So
how many gay soldiers did you know?
None.
Really?
There was one girl who I suspected.
Right.
But definitely nobody came out.
Yeah.
And this is the Air Force.
But you couldn't. I mean, you'd have been drummed out.
Actually, no, there was one guy. He was thrown out.
Oh, see? There you go.
He was in the process of being thrown out when I knew him.
Wow. So, but to get back to Clinton, I think that she's got that weird bifurcation that Democrats have, that when it comes to, that they have to appear tough, So she's got, I mean, she's to the right of Obama when it comes to military use of military, when it comes to security, and I would do air quotes in that, probably when it comes to intelligence gathering at home and abroad. But, you know, we know that on domestic policy, she's very firmly progressive. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, she's got a lot of Wall Street cronies behind her, so who knows what's going to happen with that. But at this point, I think, you know, we've lost to the oligarchs in general. I would just, frankly, I would just like to see somebody emerge that is not a, that is not Clinton, just that surprises us, just to have the debate. What, you know, Sanders will be easily isolated. It would be interesting to see, you know, whether it's the governor of Maryland, Mike Malloy. No, not Mike Malloy. He's a, who is it?
I know who you're talking about, but the name is now
Malloy, sort of, isn't it?
I think it is Malloy, yeah. But not Mike.
Not Mike.
Mike's the radio guy, right?
Radio guy, yeah.
I would actually like to have Mike Malloy on the show at some point. I think he would be interesting.
He's crazy, but delightfully so.
Is he? that's the impression that I get. Yeah. What could Hillary do and say? We're really running over some of this. I'm probably going to have to cut out. What would Hillary have to do or say to make you more comfortable? Could she do or say?
No, anything? She couldn't. But I mean, I'm going to vote for her. I mean, who the fuck else am I going to vote for?
Right.
I mean, that's really where a lot of us are, is like, all right, this is sort of our, you know, forced march into, you know, I'm not going to not vote. I mean, I think that's a dumb position. Because, again, what it comes down to for me is...
I've seen a lot of progressives saying that they're not going to vote. And yeah, the one point that I try to keep making to them is the Supreme Court.
Right.
Even if this person isn't going to move the needle at all in the progressive direction.
Right.
The Supreme Court is 30, 40 years.
We've seen what the Supreme Court appointments do.
Yeah.
If you do not think that that is a major issue, and you know,
just in the last few months,
right? Well, you know, I can't wait for, you know, the next if Scalia were to drop dead, fingers crossed, there would be a titanic battle. Right now, they would filibuster. So it would be a filibuster of Supreme Court appointments.
I think you'd see the Senate again rewriting the rules on that.
Yep,
we'd have to get somebody through.
Yep.
Speaking of the Senate, it's actually a very good segue.
Yes.
What do you see happening? I took a look.
I got no idea, man. It goes back and forth all the time. What do you got?
So I took a look at Real Clear Politics again. Nate Silver. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a lot of respect for the guy, and. He has it right now at 45 Democrats to 46 Republicans. He has 9 toss-ups. I looked at the toss-ups. Dems are ahead in Alaska, Michigan, and Louisiana, which is 48 seats. Republicans are ahead in 4 seats. That gives them 50. And there are 2 states that are dead even. Now, a lot of things can happen in those 9 races that are so close in 2 months.
The only thing I'll add to it, because I honestly don't know. And don't want to pretend. I think it just keeps swinging constantly at this point. Although it's seeming less and less likely that that Republicans are going to be able to solid. It might go to 50-50 with Biden breaking the tie, which I think is probably more likely now than Republicans taking over. But I was down in Louisiana for part of my vacation. That would be the non-vacation part of the vacation. I was visiting family, and one relative of mine. Republican said, "Oh yeah, I'm voting for Mary Landrieu.
She has something that
she is the oil industry's best friend, and if you support Louisiana, you support the oil industry, and if you support the oil industry, you support Mary Landrieu." I had another Republican relative, and both of them male, who said, "There's no way I'm voting for Mary Landrieu." And I said, "Why?" And he said, she's a bitch." And I said,
okay.
And I said, well, you know, this is older relative. And he said, and I said, okay, but why aren't you voting for her? And he said, oh, we need some new blood in there. And I said, okay, but why are you voting for her?
Yeah.
I forget who the Republican opponent is. There was no good reason. There was just a gut level, you know, screw her. You know, she's a Democrat and a bitch, I guess. Although I've never really known that she was...
Yeah, she
bitchy.
Seems like a nice lady.
No, every time I've ever seen her speak, she's been, yeah.
whatever it is that a Democrat has to do to win a statewide race in Louisiana, I think she has cracked the code.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, but the thing is like, you know, Louisiana does have its, you know, does have that underlying democratic foundation. But you know, if you're doing good for the oil industry, you're going to win.
Okay. Well, you know, I have no problems with Democrats doing what they need to win in a state like that. I mean, what's the alternative? I mean, look at the other guy who is representing the Senate in Louisiana.
Oh, God. Yeah. Vitter.
He is the most rated as the most Republican, most conservative voting guy in the Senate. I mean, is that, do we want to get so angry that somebody is a moderate to conservative Democrat that we have another Vitter? Because that's what her opponent is like, too.
Right. And I think that, you know, for a long time, I was one of those people that back during, I voted for Nader. Back when, because I was like, oh, there's no difference between Bush and Gore.
Oof.
You know? I was totally complete. Now, I voted for Nader in a state that was going for Bush no matter what.
Okay.
You know, the guy, had I been in a swing state or in that election in 2000, I would have voted for Gore. But I was following that Molly Ivins, let's give Ralph Nader 5% so that we can get a third party getting funding.
Mm-hmm.
And but there is a difference. And there is a difference even for, you know, as reprehensible a Democrat as Joe Manchin than having a Republican from West Virginia in there. Because if nothing else, there's at least a chance that that Democrat is going to vote with the president, you know, assuming it's a Democratic president, you know, in 2016 going forward.
And even the most conservative Democrat does about 80% of the time.
Right. But the Republican organization is just going to join the filibuster, the standing filibuster.
Yeah. That'll be a zero.
Right.
0%.
Right. So at this point, there is always a difference. And for progressives to pretend there isn't is a huge lie that is going to bite them in our utopian asses.
And I'll give you the last word. That's all we have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser and the Rude Pundit will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio next Sunday, August 24th, and Monday, August 25th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow The Rude Pundit at rudepundit.blogspot.com and follow me in the show on Twitter at Steven Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.